I was a very lonely kid. I got along with my parents and with adults, but with other kids I didn't get along well at all. And food was that comfort. Food was a friend. And it would make me feel good for a little while. So if I had a hard day at school, I could eat, and the eating would make it better. The older that I got and the more body conscious I became, the harder it was to maintain the normality, to maintain a stable body weight. So if you were to look at a photo timeline of me, I would have gone from chubby to skinny and chubby to thin and chubby to thin, and then progressively larger every time. It got worse every time. It would usually start with a craving after a big emotional event. Something happened that upset me, something that happened that I couldn't really handle, and the first thought was, I need ice cream, I need this, I need that. And I would go and get it. And then my head would start to race from the sugar. And it would just make everything worse. So it was this really vicious cycle of hurting, needing to get the food, ingesting the food, hating myself for ingesting the food, being disgusted with myself and ashamed for doing it, and then needing more because I was so afraid of alienating the few people that I had in my life. I really felt like if they knew me and they knew what was happening, they wouldn't care about me, they wouldn't love me. So then I'd need to eat over that. And then when I couldn't get enough sugar from the food, I started to compulsively drink too. There was no rest. There was no peace ever. And when it got really, really bad, I tried to kill myself to stop it, to just make my head quiet for a while. And gratefully, I wasn't able to do it.
Welcome to Unhooked. My name is Pastor Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Kitty, and today we're going to be talking about overeating.
It's really good to have our guests here today. We have Barbara Dickinson and Laurel Warner. Thanks so much for being with us.
Can you tell us what's the difference between overeating or binge eating or compulsive eating?
Well, I'll start. Binge eating basically is individuals eating episodically large quantities of food that ordinarily someone that you and I would not eat with in that setting. It's eating in secrecy. It's also eating all of this food and then feeling shame, guilt, a sense of disgust. Usually they eat this amount of food where they are eating and they cannot tell that they are full. They just continue to eat.
Overeating is something that happens to many people without having an eating disorder itself. And compulsive overeating is similar to binge eating, but there may be a little different emotional flavor to it. Many times people choose different foods, or they've been going all day long without eating anything, and then something happens at work or whatever, and then they feel compelled that they have to eat. So binge eating and compulsive eating are pretty close.
They're very close. People that sometimes that are compulsive overeaters may engage in binge eating, or they may engage in what's called grazing, where they're just continuing to eat, going back and just eating, and not paying attention to the amount over time. Binge eating is within a very discrete period of time.
Sure. So can you talk to us a little bit about maybe who's most prone to this sort of behavior?
The binge eating, overeating?
Eating, overeating type of thing.
It's going to be somebody who, some may have started out dieting. Maybe they've been overweight. Not all people who binge are overweight. That can be tied in with some the restricting side of things, too. Somebody who's mindset-wise may have told themselves they can't eat certain foods, they have to eat this way only, and diet, and then they just get overwhelmed and go back to eating whatever they considered that they couldn't eat before.
Or someone that might be prone to either binge eating or compulsive overeating, it might be linked to a trauma or some kind of an emotional experience where we're using food to feel good or to de-stress. The fact of the matter is that there really isn't a specific prototype. Mm-hmm. A lot of people can.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing sounds like an addiction in a way, then.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
I think it can be. I think there's a similarity. I know with the people that I work with in chemical dependency, which is a subset of things I do, many times they stop using a substance and they'll start turning to food, particularly sugar, in order to feel good again.
Sure, yeah. Sounds like it's a way that people cope. You mentioned the stressors in life and maybe a traumatic experience. And one of the ways that they get through that grieving, they eat. And it's almost encouraged in our culture, because if you go to so many events that maybe even like a funeral or something, what do? You know, you gather and everybody eats and so forth. So.
Exactly. Or if you don't feel good or something negative happened in your life, as women, we get together with our girlfriends and we say, we're going to eat ice cream. And
we even reward children sometimes, you know, with food.
That is correct, yes.
My wife is constantly getting on my case about that. Don't reward the kids with food all the time. But it's something that we do maybe, and perhaps it could encourage a wrong behavior.
I grew up without having to have that. If we had dessert at a meal, it was part of the meal. It wasn't contingent upon having to finish what we had on the plate before. Some people who grew up that way will find themselves feeling deprived and, I couldn't eat this when I was a kid, but now I can have access to it and they'll eat whatever they want. That's more the compulsive overeating.
I'm wondering, you know, because eating is so much a part of, you know, health and so forth, what are the health concerns that relate to overeating or binge eating?
Well, I think the ones that we all know is type 2 diabetes, issues in terms of stroke and hypertension, and of course, high cholesterol.
All of those would be associated with being overweight, and it would depend partly on the person's previous medical history also, their pattern of eating. I think the pattern of people's eating can be more important than sometimes what they eat. They'll go all day long with hardly anything, and then they come home and dinner's the biggest meal.
What's the consequence of doing that?
Eating too much. There's automatic tendency to overeat when you start eating if you haven't eaten well throughout the day. And then you have a lot more fuel. That word is preferable to calories. We have a lot more fuel than we need at that one time. And there is some evidence coming out that just one episode of a very high-fat meal can stiffen the arteries in the next minutes after that meal. It isn't just
that
accumulative
fast.
That fast.
Wow.
You mentioned with binge eating that those persons aren't always overweight. Are there health consequences with that as well, though?
The binge eating itself, I'm always tying it to bulimia, and I know we're going to talk about that in a different segment. The consequences of just bulimia, of just overeating, are going to be feeling really full. Insulin response changes. They don't feel hungry. They're going to perpetuate the pattern of maybe not eating and then going back to binging. Those are some of the things.
And then there's also mental health concerns as well. Depression, a sense of shame, a sense of feeling loss of control, and overeating is very much linked to obsessive and compulsive behavior.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask too, just thinking in terms of how does someone feel? What are their emotions? What are their emotional states maybe that's going on with them?
When they're before or after?
Well, before and after, I guess.
Well, because I'm speaking from one who, when under emotions and stress, I'm going to go the opposite way and probably not eat very much. But some people, that stress response, the fight or flight, and I don't know the details, you might know, but some people are driven in that emotional upset to find a way to self-medicate or feel better, and food becomes that.
For sure.
And it changes your brain chemistry. It changes your mood.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and oftentimes when you are feeling down, if you think about food, especially food that makes you feel good, your brain releases endorphins.
Yeah.
And then the anticipation of eating this big bowl of ice cream really just fires the neurons. And so I think...
No, it does. Wow. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break and be right back.
I I was really struggling for a period of years, for almost 8 years, with depression, anxiety. Then I got pregnant with my son and had really bad postpartum after that. And the eating was continuing through this whole time. So I was sleep deprived, I had postpartum, and I had my disease. I was face down in it, and drinking too. In the meantime, my relationship with my husband was deteriorating. It got to the point where we'd go out and he'd say, okay, just watch what you eat, and can you only have, you know, one glass of wine when we went to a party? And it was impossible, because once I got there, I'd station myself across from the food and I'd be done. So I made a decision to see a different type of therapist and made the decision to be completely honest, which I hadn't done before. I really guarded my mind. My mind was the only place where I could be safe. And I realized I was never going to get better with whatever was wrong with me, and something was definitely wrong with me, until I could be honest with someone else. And about 9 months after I started therapy, we went on a vacation. It was a beautiful place. We were at family camp with our best friends. It was gorgeous, and for the first time, my mind was sort of slow. And I remember distinctly having a meal, and I was sitting across from my best friend's husband, and they brought dessert around. I was ecstatic. I'm like, yes, like, set me up. This is perfect. And I looked at him and I said, aren't you gonna have any? And he looked at me, and I swear there was sadness in his eyes. And he said, no, you know, I'm gonna wait, because we're gonna have s'mores at the campfire later. And I couldn't even stop myself. I just said, and? Because in my mind, why not? One was never enough. 100 was never enough. There was just no off switch. I just needed more all the time. And later that day, I was walking across the campsite, blue sky, and just had this feeling and this thought, you are a compulsive eater. I didn't even know what it meant. And when we got home, I told my doctor about it, and he suggested a recovery group, and I went. But before I had done that, we had a party at the same friend's house. I ate and drank for 4 hours. And when I got home, my husband had to bring me home. I could barely walk. Walked into the house, I felt like my stomach was gonna break open. And I'd never felt that before with eating, not like this. It was so painful. And I remember thinking the last thoughts I had before I passed out were, you deserve this. You deserve this pain. You did this to yourself. And that's when I knew it was a life or death decision for me. I would either lose my life or I'd lose my husband and my son. And I knew I was standing on a very, very shaky cliff. And when it's a life or death decision, it's a really easy one to make.
Welcome back, where we've been talking about overeating. I'm thinking about in our community where we hear always, you know, larger is better, or we often hear supersize me, you know, make it a larger one. How is that impacting maybe the next generation, even with our children and the mentality of that?
Go ahead first.
I was thinking about the fact that a lot of the foods that we supersize are foods that are high in sugar, fat, and salt. And there is significant research that call those food hyperpalatable food, because it really triggers the reward system in the brain. And it, again, releases the endorphins and make us feel good. So,
and you want to have that again.
And you want to have it again over and over, over and again. Over.
Something I've noticed over the years, and the era that I grew up in, the portion sizes were what I would consider normal. They're the sizes that you would find in a computer analysis program to compare, say, a food record with or something. And so people, there's generations of kids who are growing up with a portion size that they now think is one, what it's really representing two or three times something. French fries, for example.
Yeah.
So sometimes it isn't just the food itself. True, it can be high fat and cause problems, but it's the portion size that is more likely to be the problem, not the food necessarily itself.
Yeah. So what can families do if they're going to help someone who's struggling with this sort of issue? What can families do to help get them back on the right track?
I think one of the really important things is to set boundaries. very crucial for individuals that struggle with overeating or compulsive eating would be to have a structured plan, wouldn't you say?
Yes, a structured plan. And for families to eat together. There is huge amounts of research on this.
Okay.
For not necessarily with overeating and eating disorders, but even with mental health and teenagers. And our culture has gotten away from that, that we don't sit down to eat together. And it doesn't have to be a fancy, long, prepared meal. It just needs to be together.
So how does that contribute to helping someone who's struggling with overeating?
Well, I think one of the issues with overeating, again, portion size. You eat a lot, or you may keep eating. If you have a structured time, dinner is at 5 or 6 or when we get home, and you are all sitting at the table, and you're eating, people tend to not eat as much
when
they're
around. So there's some built-in accountability
there?
There is
built-in accountability. Okay. You're not alone, because with binge eating, that's also one of the big things, is to eat alone and eat large portions.
The other thing, if a person, and this would have to be something I would say the family members would want to talk about, if there's a person struggling and they sit down to eat together, that they've decided ahead of time what kind of support they might need, like a gentle, if they're sitting next to them, hey, you're eating a little fast. And then you go right on into the conversation, so you're not making a spectacle of that person, because that's not going to help.
Right, and then I think also with that is also planning meals together.
Yeah.
What will the meal look like,
and
just making that just a part of the family process.
Sure.
What are some treatment things, or would somebody who has overeating, would treatment be an important thing for them?
I think so, but it would be needs to be a comprehensive treatment, because it isn't only about the food, the physical side, which I deal with more than the therapy side. It needs to look at the whole picture of why they're doing that, and include the family, not just the person. But a program that looks at that would be good.
Right. So again, it has to be holistic. Very crucial is helping them to understand what is the emotions and the feeling that's linked to the food, being able to identify it and express it, to articulate it. That would be crucial. Another crucial aspect of treatment would be group support.
Yeah.
That's very crucial. When you have those kinds of support, it builds an accountability, but it also reduces a sense of isolation, a sense of I'm alone in all this.
Sure.
Really crucial, as well as the thinking. How am I thinking, and how is it that I am linking food in my mind? Those are some of the really crucial aspects in terms of treatment.
You know, I'm thinking about, you know, the television and watching, you know, what's on TV and different things and the messages that we receive from the culture. How is that contributing in a negative way to the overeating that we're seeing in the culture today? And the fact that our president's wife has to do, you know, a program on obesity, to fight obesity. What's going on with that?
She's approaching it from a wellness standpoint, hopefully. One of the things, even with the food that a lot of people turn to, which isn't necessarily the best choice if it's always high fat, I think it's important not to induce a sense of guilt just because you might like that. People like things that are refined. They like some of these high-fat things. And if you can learn to include those in a way that isn't destructive, you're going to have much more success than if you're constantly saying, I can't have this, but you really want it.
Right.
And that creates a problem. You'll go back to the overeating.
So the issue is moderation. Because with food, you need food to live. So you can't stop eating. But you can certainly learn how to use moderation. You can learn to understand what are the things that I crave.
Yeah.
And how can I fulfill my craving in a way that's not destructive?
For sure. Mm-hmm.
We hear of persons who really have significant issues with overeating, who may become morbidly obese, and some of those treatments then require, or sometimes are recommended to have, more of a surgical response as well. I know that seems to be something more happening these days.
It's more prevalent. I've worked with a number of people, unfortunately, who've come to a disordered eating program and have had the bariatric surgery, the gastric bypass type surgery. Before anybody considers that, they really need to be evaluated and have a chance to practice some of the things they're going to need to practice emotionally, mentally, before they have that surgery, because it will cause a lot of problems.
There's going to have to be the life change afterwards anyway.
Exactly. Correct? Yes. So the surgery, it's not the magic bullet, so to speak. And I think that's a crucial thing for people to understand.
Absolutely. There really is no magic bullet.
No.
Thanks so much for being with us, Barbara and Laurel. You've been terrific. We appreciate you being on the program. Unhooked, we'll be right back.
The recovery group that my doctor had suggested opened the doors for me to experience addiction with other people that have the same addiction I do. And it was such a relief to have a name for what I was. I wasn't scared anymore because I knew that I could identify myself and face myself, and then there was hope for me to get better. That, for me, is living a lifestyle of abstinence from sugar and flour and alcohol. And it also means weighing and measuring my meals, and I only eat 3 meals a day. So I'm getting what my body needs instead of what I want. As it became a lifestyle, it became easier to do. And then the real work started. As my body and my mind were in balance, my spiritual side was very weak, and I could feel it. And I could feel that just going through the motions wasn't going to work anymore. I started to realize that God was with me the entire time. God has been with me every step of the way. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here because I'd be dead. God's the one that stopped me from killing myself. God's the one that made me realize I needed to tell the truth. God was the one who was with me when I was walking across that campground and telling me the name of my disease when I had no clue what that meant. I'm starting to realize that God does love me. In fact, I had an experience the other day that I don't think I would have been able to experience before. I don't think the timing would have been right either. I was cleaning out the chicken's pen that I do every morning, and I heard a buzzing sound. And I looked up, and there was a hummingbird caught inside the pen and was just frantic and scared and couldn't get out. And so I was kind of struck by how extraordinary that is anyway, and I tried to hurt him. And he kept flitting from one side to the other, and this went on. I was trying to get ready to go to work, and this went on for what felt like 10 minutes. I remember thinking, I'm going to be out here all morning. How can I get? And the door was propped open, and this little bird couldn't see its way out. And it finally stopped on the edge of the pen, and I walked over to it, and I talked to it, and I was able to put my hand around it. And it stared at me for a long time, and I said a little prayer to help me get him off, because he was holding on for dear life, so that I could let him out. And as I opened my hand, he flew away, and then he was back in the other corner and scared and chirping and just, and he sat on the side of the pen again, and I went over and I was able to get a hand underneath and gently take his feet off, and I came around the corner and released him into the yard, and he flew across the yard and landed in a tree. And I was so overwhelmed by that experience, by just how special that was, that it didn't hit me until later on. And I came in the house and couldn't wait to tell my husband what had happened. And he actually had just looked out the window as I was releasing him. So he saw me holding this hummingbird. And we both looked at each other and he said, "That doesn't happen, right?" I said, "Right, that doesn't happen." That was God. But what I realized later on was that that bird was me. And I was God in my recovery program, helping me find the way. My name is Stacy, and I'm unhooked.
Hello, friends. We've just heard from Barbara and Laurel about overeating and the many different forms that it can take. We all need food to live, and so food is an extremely important part of healthful living. But as with any other addiction, anything can be done to excess, and food is one of those things that unfortunately many people use to excess. Now, we all know about lifestyle programs and learning healthy eating through a New Start and other forms of healthful lifestyle programs. But one of the things that we've learned is this, that for many people, eating is associated with basic human needs like comfort. Think about this for a moment. When you were a baby and you were nursing at your mother, what was happening? Not only were your physical need for food being met, but also what was being met is your need for comfort. You were being held by your mother, you were being nursed by your mother, and so there's a natural association between love and comfort and food. This fundamental basic need is so important because when our needs for love and connection have not been met, many people then naturally gravitate toward food. In doing so, though, what we don't understand is that we have a God who calls himself the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our tribulations. This God of comfort is better than any food, better than anything we can drink. His comfort is lasting comfort. The kind of comfort you get with God is comfort that stays with you no matter what the circumstances of your life are. We're always going to have trials and difficulties throughout our life because life is not fair. But when we learn to go to God to get our needs for comfort met rather than to food, we're truly blessed because His comfort, rest in Him, is truly satisfying like nothing else can ever do. And so, if you have a need for comfort, if you want to know how to overcome, for more information about how to break away from habits that hurt, contact Adventist Recovery Ministries, and for prayer, call 1-888-446-7388. Choose to become unhooked today.